Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health. I'm Lindsay Carr, the associate editor for Contemporary OBGYN. You'll hear from me as well as my senior editor, Angie DeRosa. Hello, this is Angie DeRosa, senior editor of Contemporary OBGYN. We continue our coverage of COVID-19 and its impact to pregnancy with videos and articles online. The case with COVID-19, especially when it comes to its impact to pregnant women, is constantly evolving. The data are coming in slowly, and we are providing whatever information we can to keep you informed from experts' perspectives. The latest expert that we interview is Dr. Christina Adams Waldorf. She is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington in Seattle, which was a canary in the coal mine regionally for the United States for the outbreak of COVID-19. She also happens to be an internationally renowned expert in pregnancy infections. Dr. Adams Waldorf is a standing member of the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development Obstetrics and Maternal Fetal Biology Study Section. She is a member of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Zika Expert Working Group, which is an advisory group to ACOG on its Zika virus response efforts. And that's in collaboration with organizations such as the CDC, AAP, and health departments. The Adams Waldorf Research Laboratory is conducting research ongoing into the impact of COVID-19 for pregnant women and the babies. You can find more of our articles and more information online at www.contemporaryobgyn.net. In the meantime, enjoy this interview with Dr. Adams Waldorf. Thank you. We are talking here today with Dr. Christina Adams Waldorf. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And she's also an internationally renowned expert on infectious disease in pregnancy. And so, welcome today, Dr.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And so we were talking a few minutes ago about your experience with infectious diseases in pregnancy. And so what I would like to start off with is talking about, because you are in Seattle, and it was sort of the canary in the coal mine regionally, and for us, ACOG was canceled there, and so much was going on. What have you seen? What has been your experience there?
When I saw that China was losing control and containment of the virus in mid-January, I launched my COVID-19 program then. So I've been working on this now for close to 3.5 months. And there were two things that I wanted to do. One was to look on a population level in Washington State to determine what the outcomes would be, mainly for maternal health and obstetrical complications, but also neonatal health, because I have an interest in this. And the second thing that I wanted to do was to look in the laboratory and understand how this virus works, what it does to placental cells, how it induces immune responses in the placenta, and what that might mean for stillbirth, miscarriage, fetal growth restriction, and other kinds of more subtle obstetrical complications that viruses oftentimes cause, but can be a little bit harder to detect. and link back to the virus. And then I wanted to link those two research programs together to really understand what COVID-19 might be doing to pregnant women so that we could make a public health impact.
And when you talk about some of those more subtle obstetrical complications, what are some of those?
Well, if we take the Zika epidemic, for example, the very first thing that came out was that newborns had microcephaly. We should be looking at microcephaly. We should be measuring the head circumference of these neonates. But as you know, fetal brain development is much more complicated than that. And it wasn't long before we realized that the spectrum of fetal brain anomalies and injuries and central nervous system injuries was much, much bigger than this.
Okay.
And then we also learned that Zika virus caused miscarriage and that fetal growth was not necessarily normal. And now we even know that IQ and cognitive development is somewhat abnormal, even in children that had a normal head circumference at birth. So it's kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion. And SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, is, you know, nothing like Zika. No one's really looking at birth defects here. That's not kind of what it does. But so many viruses can have an impact on miscarriage, stillbirth, fetal growth, and other obstetrical complications. And this one has such an incredibly important impact on maternal health that there's just a lot of questions that we need to research and do so quickly.
And so has your experience there with the patient population, pregnant women, been better or worse than you anticipated?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a cousin to SARS-CoV-2 is SARS-CoV-1, and there were some case series that looked particularly ominous in terms of stillbirth and maternal death and so forth. Another cousin is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Distress Syndrome coronavirus, MERS-CoV, and the case series there have looked very ominous in terms of neonatal death. But there's so many differences in terms of how we practice, the hospitals that were available, the way that a pandemic can impact public health response. It was completely unclear whether COVID-19 would resemble those viruses or not. The first couple of case series that we saw out of Wuhan and then out of New York painted a different picture.
Okay.
We weren't looking so much at maternal death, but there was, some concern for women that became really sick, multi-organ dysfunction, and even stillbirth. And now the question has become even broader. Do we have transmission of the virus from the mother to the infant in utero or at the time of delivery? We're seeing a lot of suspicious cases that keep mounting that are suggesting that there is likely vertical transmission in utero. But how sick does the baby get? We don't know.
That's very interesting, because on a couple of the other interviews and the information we have to date, vertical transmission has not yet been seen, right? Or had not been in the interviews we had done. So I'd like, go ahead, and can you expand on that more for what you've seen?
My guess is, and like many viruses, you've got a very short viremic window in which to catch it in the act. Right now, our best diagnostic tests are qualitative and quantitative PCR testing, and so many people have access to that. Fewer people have access to good antibody tests, and those are being developed and being rolled out and being validated just now. So vertical transmission ideally would be demonstrated both using a PCR test and using an antibody test in the neonate looking for IgM, which is a giant antibody that doesn't cross the placenta.
Okay.
So if IgM is present in neonatal cord blood, it suggests that the infant themselves had an immune response to the virus. And we can have very specific assays to look for IgM specific for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19.
Is there any indication on transmission via breast milk?
Breast milk, we have not seen that. There's not a lot of data on it. We have not seen data there that looks suggestive. So that's very fortunate and seems like it will be safe to breastfeed. But now we're getting up into the 10 plus cases of SARS-CoV-2 viral RNA present by PCR in newborns, and even a few cases with IgM. So I think that if you're testing all the newborns from pregnant women that had a COVID-19 infection, most of them will probably be negative, but you might have missed the window where you could ideally test for this. And even with Zika, not all of the Zika neonates that were exposed in utero had antibodies at the time. So it's kind of tricky. It's very time sensitive. So I think that we have to be really careful when we talk to pregnant women about the risk of transmission from mother to fetus.
Okay. And so that, and I want to go into detail now about your lab, about the Adams Waldorf lab at the university. Is it the University of Seattle University, and about the research, specific research that you are conducting into this? You're still looking for participants. Is that correct?
That's right. So we're beyond our public health research that we're doing in Washington State, we are also inviting women that have COVID-19 in pregnancy to enroll in our studies. I'm very interested in the early immune response to COVID-19 because that shapes the placental immune response to COVID-19. And if the placenta has something akin to a cytokine storm, which can happen in some women that become really sick, then I think that it will be very, very bad for the pregnancy. And what, you know, what are the factors that go into that? So much work needs to be done.
And can you talk about how many participants you have now? Or is that a moving?
We're just kind of getting started. Even though I started so early, there are so many barriers to doing research with COVID-19. And I think at probably many universities in the country, lots of people have dropped everything to study COVID-19. And so the influx of studies and to study COVID-19, both for our institutional review board and all the different regulatory agencies, has been incredibly intense. What the University of Washington did was to set up a review process to review all of these studies to ensure that patients weren't being bombarded with different consent forms and you know, all at once. It's a very, very sensitive research arena. We're just getting started. The University of Washington is fully on board, and we're starting to reach out to our partner institutions so that we can expand the study. We had quite a few patients right in the beginning, around the time of COVID-19 surge in Washington State, which was not quite a month ago. But it seems like our plateau just, you know, we just aren't dropping the number of cases as quickly as we had hoped. And now we're starting to worry that this will be a longer tail to kind of ride out. So I think enrollment will come along slower than it will for many studies. But I'm also very grateful that the public health response has been so strong in Washington State.
Yeah. And so I wanted to talk about, before we go into the question about monitoring fetal growth, I wanted to take a step back. Dr. Spong did an editorial that'll appear in the May issue of Contemporary OBGYN about what you touched on in that other video that I watched about the structure that should be in place, because these pathogens exist for us and pandemics are going to be a part of the human experience. And so you had said if we can develop systems and infrastructure to study the effect of emerging pathogens on pregnant women and newborns. How would that come to be in from your expert perspective? What would that system and infrastructure look like?
I think that the investigators who are committed to studying pregnancy can absolutely do this. We just need to go about this in a smarter way than we've done before. We need to think more broadly and create all of our research programs to be more nimble so that we can shift and pivot when new pathogens emerge, as they call it in the infectious disease world. And as we see destruction of our biosphere, more of these viruses will emerge. They're typically RNA viruses. We've had six global World Health Organization global public health emergencies since the swine flu of 2009, which many of us remember when we had pregnant women dying in our ICUs. And so what I did for the Washington State Pregnancy Collaborative, is when I got approval for this and approval with all of my partners, I said, I want to study COVID-19 or influenza or any other infectious disease period that affects pregnant women so that we're ready. The next one comes, we're already in place, we have all of our partners, we can study this on a population-based, with a population-based approach, which is incredibly hard to do in the United States. But we need to do this. This is what the pandemic has, you know, brought upon us as researchers, and this is our job.
Yes, and you're obviously involved with ACOG. And it's Zika virus response team, yes. And I wanted to talk to you about, is that same type of response team in place?
I think that ACOG is doing its best to get information out to all of its members. And sometimes these committees take a little bit longer to form. Unfortunately, this has been a patchwork of public health responses. Each state has been on their own. There have been chaotic, diverse, and strange messages coming from the White House. And whenever that happens on a national level, people die. All of us, I think, have been in emergency mode at our own institutions. All of the protocols for COVID-19 are publicly available from the University of Washington. I urge you to go to that website, everything that you need, how to transport a patient, how to take samples, how to do a C-section, all of that is there so that we can kind of help each other. And I don't know anyone right now who isn't drowning in about 300 plus emails a day, new policies that are changing every single day. We're all trying to keep up. It's getting a little better for us now in Seattle as we're, something like 3 weeks past the peak, but we're still in plateau. We're still seeing a lot of cases. And so I think we're all in this together, and I know that ACOG is doing everything it can to support us.
Yes, absolutely. We actually did a list and been following on their site, everything that they're doing, but we hear from, the doctors all across the country about what they're facing. And it's interesting in different pockets, what you'll hear. We did the interview with Dr. Laura Riley, out of New York Presbyterian. She was recovering from COVID. She had had it herself. So it's just, you guys are heroes. I need to say that. And I need to say thank you for what you're doing. Really. I mean that sincerely. And so we'll go into the next question about the importance of monitoring the fetal growth. So can you talk about that, the importance of monitoring the fetal growth?
Sure. When we know essentially nothing about a new virus, everything is off the table. And so when the first couple of case series came out and I saw a lot of media attention And reports saying that pregnant women are not a vulnerable group to COVID-19. That kind of didn't sit very well with me. Okay. Because the first few case series and the first few reports really don't even touch upon the granularity of maternal, fetal, neonatal outcomes that we really need to make a statement like that. So I think that we need to look at our research, take a very measured look at this, and possibly walk that public health narrative back. When you're an obstetrician, you know, it's not just about the mom. It's also about the baby. It's complex.
Yes.
We need to look at all of those things before we make a decision about whether or not pregnant women are in a higher risk group or not. I think that it's hard for pregnant women not to be in a higher risk group. There's so much at stake. If preterm birth is performed because a pregnant mother's lungs are deteriorating,
yes,
that to me is an outcome that just that alone would warrant her to be in a higher risk group from COVID-19. We know this, we're obstetricians. This is our everyday life. And what we need to do is to be absolutely on the front with a public health message about this and the impact on our patients.
Now, can you tell me what you have seen in terms of pregnant women who have died during pregnancy?
We fortunately have not had in our system a pregnant woman who has died, which is, you know, so I'm so thankful for this. Someone from New York might give you a different story. Yeah. Just published, I think in this last week, was a case series out of Iran with 7 deaths of pregnant women. And again, you know, we don't know what their public health response was to the degree that their hospitals and medical systems collapsed. But I would expect that something like that happened for all of those women to die. But we don't have a really good sense of what the maternal mortality rate might be from COVID-19.
And is there anything else that we haven't covered here that you would like to include or make sure that you say to the audience?
Yeah, sure. First, I want to say thank you to everyone who is doing their part to do their job. It's just incredibly hard time right now. Take care of yourselves, and we'll get through this together, and we will learn from it, and we'll be stronger.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.